All right, thank you. Thank you very much to the organizers for the chance to speak here and also really for the chance to listen here, because I really wanted to, there's been lots for me to learn here, and I'm sure there's more that I'm going to learn through the rest of the workshop. I realize, so my abstract says I'm going to talk about Little Richardson rules for the cohomology of, for the torus equivariant cohomology of Grassmannians, and but I realize that I'm here talking to an audience of people who really are kind of symmetric functions people, or you know, or are pretending to be, or are disguised as, or something. I mean, so it seemed reasonable to focus on the symmetric functions perspective on what I'm doing, and this is the perspective that is the this factorial sure polynomials is the symmetric functions point of view on cohomology of equivariant cohomology of Grassmannians. I should say this is all joint work with Alex Yong, continuing a lot of work that we've done previously. It's going to be pretty elementary because I don't know very much. So I will try to provide good definitions and hopefully clear statements, and please interrupt me if I fail in my attempt, because that seems like, since I don't have that much to say, and at least I can hope to say it kind of clearly. Perhaps. I'll try. All right, this is the board it's good not to write on. I'll try to remember. For my talk, I'm going to fix a positive integer n, which is just going to be fixed for all time, and I want to consider a set of partitions, P partitions with at most n parts. A standard thing that I'm going to want to do is to talk about, so if lambda is one of these partitions, I'm going to want to talk about the semi-standard Young tableau of shape lambda. So these are fillings of the Ferrer's diagram of lambda by numbers 1 to n, which are column strict. So strictly increasing up columns, weakly increasing along rows, and I will use French notation since that seems to be what people are used to here. For example, so we can define Schur polynomials. So we have S sub lambda for lambda one of these partitions. We can take the sum, and I realize that almost everybody, maybe everybody, but knows the definition, but I want to make the definition just to point out that I'm later going to define factorial Schur polynomials, which are going to be, have a very similar definition. So let me just make the definition. We're going to take the sum over all tableau of a product over all boxes in the tableau of x sub that number in that box. So if t is a filling of lambda, then I'm writing x sub, I'm writing t of alpha for the number in the alpha box according to t. And then we're taking the product over all of those. And so this is the usual thing. Of course, because I have, so this is a polynomial in finitely many variables. So I'm here working with just to begin with one set of variables, x's, and there are finitely many. They're just numbered 1 to n. So there we are. We have some polynomial. It is true but not so obvious. Let me just say F lambda is a symmetric polynomial. In other words, it is in the part of the polynomial ring that is fixed by the symmetric group, acting on by permuting the variables. Okay. And indeed, it forms these guys for lambda in my set P, these guys form a Z basis. Okay. So if we were curious, we might then say, I have S lambda. If I take S lambda and I multiply it times S mu, that's going to be symmetric again. Add two symmetric things and multiply them together, still symmetric. And therefore, we can expand it in terms of S mu's. And of course, this is sort of old mu's. And so when we expand it, we get some numbers. See, lambda mu nu. Which are actually non-negative integers in this expansion. And okay, so now I want to actually remind you of one of the formulations of a rule to calculate this, these C lambda mu nu's. I apologize to the people. I'll try to go at a reasonable pace, but I'd like anybody that doesn't know how to calculate these to know how to calculate them at the end of my talk, or indeed in like after a couple of minutes. I hope that's okay. There's many beautiful rules for calculating these. And let me tell you one of them. So I'm going to do this in a slightly non-standard way. I mean, I'm going to do this in a slightly non-standard way, because I'm going to do it using Judith Akang, of course, because everything I do is Judith Akang, currently. So let me describe how Judith Akang works quickly. And the whole point of this is that this is leading up to, I mean, for those of you who are thinking ahead, this is all leading up to a similar description of what's going on for factorial. Okay, so how it works. So consider, suppose lambda is contained in shape lambda is contained in the shape for nu, and we consider semi-standard fillings of that shape nu of the shape nu remove lambda. So if, for example, mu were 3, 3, 1. No, sorry, let me make it 3, 2, 1. And lambda were 2, 1. We would draw a picture that looks like that, which is a picture of mu. We would remove the three boxes for lambda, and we would be left with three boxes. And we now want to consider semi-standard fillings of that, and maybe this example is a little too small. So I want to use numbers 1 to n only. And so they're supposed to be weakly increasing along. Oh, shoot! People were chortling, and I didn't figure out why people were chortling quite fast enough. So people were chortling because I have drawn this upside down. I am...
I actually like it better that way.
Right. Well, yes, it's all terribly confusing. My native language is English, but I do also speak French. Not, of course, that it really matters for these. But anyway, so we take some filling, which is increasing along rows, increasing up the columns, and for example, we might take that filling. Let me clarify that we're going to just work on one at a time. We take a semi-standard filling. Here's one, for example. And now what do we do? Choose a northeasternmost box of lambda, move into it the smaller of its two northern or eastern neighbors, repeat until no longer, repeat until you have a skew shape again, and finally go back to the beginning and repeat until you have a straight shape, i.e. So let's sort of watch this in action here. Oh, it burbles when I jump about. Is that the case? I should try to be calm. Okay. So, we look at our filling, and we pick a box as far that way as possible. In this case, we have two choices. So let's pick, for example, this box. And we move into it the smaller of the neighbor above it and the neighbor to the east of it. In this case, the smaller one is the one. We move in the one. And now we think of this, well, now we have this sort of hole here, but the hole, if you imagine this was a bigger filling, this hole would be kind of awkwardly in the middle of stuff. And so that's what this step is saying. It's saying, you know, go back to this step and keep doing this until the hole has made it all the way through. So we would look at its neighbors and we'd move something in, and we would, you know, the hole would keep moving up through the filling until it had finally bubbled out the top. So this is an advantage of the French notation. They understand how bubbles work. Bubbles go up. So we've done that, and now we don't yet have a straight shape because there's still stuff down here at the bottom. And so what we do is we go back here and we look for a northeasternmost possible box in what's left down below here. And again, in this case, we don't have any choices. We have to choose this one. We choose it. We move in the smaller of the two neighbors. In this case, it's the one. We move it in. And again, we were lucky. Our bubble has bubbled all the way through very quickly because we had only a few numbers to start with. Finally, we're here. We look at its neighbors. They agree. So this you can avoid by not using semi-standard, but you can also avoid by specifying a tie-breaking rule. And the tie-breaking rule is that you prefer to move in the north guy. And there's a good reason for that, namely that if you do that, the result is looking kind of semi-standard, and indeed, once you finish this, it will be semi-standard again. If you did it the other way around, you would have two ones, one above the other, and that's very wrong, because columns are supposed to be strictly increasing. Right? So you go this way, and now, finally, we have a good example of a bubble that hasn't bubbled all the way through, because this is not a nice skew shape consisting of one partition minus another partition. This has a bubble in the middle. So we have to move into it the smaller of its neighbors, and if it's only one, that's just the one that there is. You move it in, and there you are. So, je ne sais quand, performed on a semi-standard filling. So you can do that with any semi-standard filling. Is that clear? I would like that to be clear. Okay, fantastic. I hope there was somebody in the room who didn't know how to do that, because if there wasn't, then well, that was 5 minutes of all our lives, but, you know. Okay, so Okay, so we can now describe the Littlewood-Richardson rule. So this is more or less the version du Richardson Verger. I mean, I guess this is a little bit different, but it's one of the many classical rules now for doing this. So C lambda nu is zero if lambda is not contained in mu. Remember, we really wanted lambda to be contained in mu. Otherwise, lambda is contained in mu, so the above procedure makes sense. And we consider, take all semi-standard fillings of shape mu skew lambda and count the number that rectify to somebody that I'm going to call T sub mu, which is the tableau of shape mu with row I containing just I. Okay. So this guy is an example. This guy is T 2-1. I should mention something important about this rule, which is there were some choices in this rule, right? Because we picked the box of lambda that we were going to start moving into. In this case, there was one choice. We started off by moving into this guy. We could have started off by moving into that guy. And it's important, we may as well mention the choice didn't matter. So that's just a sort of parenthetical note. But if you did the choices a different way, you would get the same result. So there's a well-defined rectification of a skew tableau into a straight-shaped tableau. You just you do this. No matter which choices you make, when you have choices, you always get the same answer. And then you count how many times you get this particularly nice answer, and that gives you the Littlewood-Richardson rule that gives you those coefficients. Okay, so now let me talk about factorial Schur functions. Okay. I'm trying to be pedagogically clever and leave on the board something that would be useful. I think that would be useful because I'm about to define the generalization. I think I'll take this off. Oh, I could just move. Oh, I could move it up, except that it's not. Well, okay, yeah. I guess I may as well move this one. And I can take this off. Okay. So now I'm going to be working over a polynomial ring in n x variables, and then an infinite number of y variables. And so I need the notion of content of a box alpha. If alpha is the box in row I and column j, and we number from left to right and from bottom up, so we number in usual Cartesian coordinates, which I understand is the reason that people like French coordinates, French notation. If you number like that, then the content of box alpha is just j minus I. Right. Now I can define the Schur polynomial, or the factorial Schur polynomial, in two sets of variables, x's and y's. So that's my notation. So it's the sum over all semi-standard tableau of shape lambda, so same kind of thing, of a product over all boxes in lambda. But now instead of just having x of the entry, we have x of the entry minus y of the entry plus the content. There we are. So that's to be compared to the familiar formula up there. And let me make some, let me do some examples just to sort of make sure we're feeling a little comfortable with it. So if we were to have just a single box, what we would get, well, we could put any number from 1 to n in that box, and therefore we get a sum with n terms in it, and the content of this box sitting here in row 1 and column 1 is 0. So that's 0. So what we get is just S of a box, xy is x1 minus y1 plus x2 minus y2 plus xn minus yn. Let's see what happens if we take n boxes. So this has the most number of rows that I was allowing myself. I was not allowing more than n rows. And you'll see why if you think about what happens if I try to fill this. It's supposed to be increasing as I go up. So the first, well, so you think about it for a moment, and you convince yourself that there's only one possible filling, the one that puts a 1 in the first row and a 2 in the second row and so forth, up to an n in the top row. And so what we get is just one term in the sum, but the product is x1 minus y1 for this bottom box, and then x2 minus y1, and x3 minus y1, so forth up to xn minus y1. So we see something a little bit surprising here, or maybe surprising, I don't know, depending on what you were expecting, you may or may not have been surprised. The important facts are that this is symmetric in x1 to xn, but it's not symmetric in the y's. That was actually already true here because we actually have infinitely many y's, so n of them showed up, but there are bigger ones, they didn't show up. That is more obvious here, only y1 is showing up at all. Okay, so it's symmetric, and the leading term, so the term with the highest degree in x is just the Schur function, Schur polynomial up there. So we see that these S lambda of xy form a z y basis for, I guess I didn't introduce my notation when I was supposed to, for the symmetric polynomials for symmetric polynomials in the x's and arbitrarily many y's, which are not symmetric. So we can, of course, ask the question, what is the, we can now take a product of two of these and expand and ask what happens. So we can say S lambda of xy times S mu of xy. I want to expand it as a sum of S mu of xy, and then we're going to get some coefficients, C lambda mu nu, which are going to be polynomials in the y variables. Okay, so we could ask about those numbers, those polynomials. Okay, I'm not going to say much about cohomology, equivariant cohomology. I guess what I will say is that these C lambda mu nu with y, some y set to 0, and the others interpreted as weights for the torus give you the coefficients for torus equivariant cohomology of Grassmannians of n planes in some big capital N. So if you know that there is a translation, then I'm just reminding you of an obvious thing. I shouldn't claim it's an obvious thing. I'm just saying there is this other interpretation. If you're comfortable with that interpretation, then you probably know this. I'm not going to really talk about it. But there is this alternative point of view. Okay, so now let me talk about a rule for this. I guess I should mention to begin with that there are rules for this. No, so I'm not claiming to have solved. A new problem here. I'll have some comments about our rule after I've actually said what our rule is. So, how does our rule work? We have a je de Sagan procedure. So you start with a semi-standard filling. Of mu skew lambda, so supposing that lambda is contained in mu, which otherwise the answer is supposed to be zero. So this is going to look very similar to something which has been erased. Okay, but it's something that is probably common knowledge to people in the room. Okay, Mark. So I'm going to be a little careful about what. About this bubble that's bubbling through. I want to be a little more precise about it than I was before. So I'm gonna mark it and then erase the mark and then remark another one and erase it, which isn't a big problem. But I'm also going to lose something from the former version of Zitzikang. So the former version we had choices. In this version, I have to specify the choice. You have to do the thing in a particular order, and that's a little disappointing. It's not so surprising, maybe, from the point of view of things like Ravi Vakil's Littlewood Richardson rule, where where there's some order in the degenerations. And anyway, I don't know. So maybe it's not that surprising, but it is something we have to do, and I would love it if we could figure out how to fix the combinatorics so we didn't have to. So you mark, in this case, the top box of the eastmost column of lambda. So remember, we have mu, we have lambda inside it. We pick the highest up box as far to the right, so we go as far to the right as possible in lambda, and then we go up as far as possible. So we have something that looks like this, let's say. So here is mu, here is lambda. We pick this guy. That's where we're going to start. So we're going to start trying to move into there. We have a basic step. Which is move into the marked box. The smaller of its north or east neighbors, or if there are no neighbors, erase the mark, or so this basic step has two possibilities: either do this thing or do another thing which I haven't told you yet. And Now, so I'm just to make clear how the overall structure works, I'm not going to tell you what this other possibility is just immediately. I'm just going to say we repeat until we have a straight shape. Okay, so there's two things that could happen at each step as we're moving into a box. We could either I should have said here, and repeat the basic step. So you know, we picked out a box, we started trying to move into it. Let's assume we never do this second thing. What I should have here is just a description of classical jeu de Sagan. So we're trying to move into this box. We pick one of the smaller neighbors. We move into it, the neighbor. We mark the box moved out of. Sorry, just to, I'm sorry. I'm trying to maybe this is overkill, but I wanted to be really clear. What's happening? There's this mark that is erased here, and then it's, you know, the neighbor moves in, and you mark the box the neighbor moved out of, and you keep going, and the mark kind of traverses its way. The mark is the bubble, and it moves its way out to a corner of mu, and then we get to this step where it has no neighbors, and we erase the mark, and we keep going. Okay? All right. So now I have to tell you about the other step, because that's sort of the interesting idea. So the interesting thing you do is the other thing you can do is fill the marked box with a number and record a weight of y n plus the content of the marked box plus 1 minus y n plus the content of the marked box. Okay, so we write down a weight, and then the coefficient C lambda mu nu is the sum over all T mu at the end. We count up how many T mu's we get of, so sum over all T mu's of the weight for each. So we just look for all the T mu's that are produced, and each of them has a weight, and we sum those weights up. So that's the rule. I tried to describe it in a way that emphasizes the fact that it's really very, 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 very similar to classical jeu de Sagan. Is the rule clear? So I'm about to do an example. So under here, so we're looking at n equals 2, lambda equals 2, 1, sorry, mu equals 2, 1, lambda equals 1. Okay, so I'm supposed to look at fillings of 2, 1, skew 1. So that means fillings. I'm filling these two boxes, and I'm allowed to use numbers 1 and 2, and the fillings have to be increasing along rows, weakly increasing along rows, strictly increasing up columns. So there are obviously four fillings that one would start with. We could put either a 1 or a 2 in each of these boxes. These two are not going to go anywhere, right? Because we, in the end, we're supposed to add up instances of this T sub mu. So remember, T sub mu is the guy who has i's in the ith row. So these two have 2's in the first row. And those 2's are not, there's no way for them to escape in the course of doing jeu de Sagan. So they're going to stay somewhere in that first row, and so they're going to kill any hope of getting out a T mu. So we can just, being clever people and not computers, we can just throw these away and not see where egg gully. So we won't consider further these two possibilities. They won't possibly produce any T mu's. So let's look over here. So we pick a box. We have only one box, so it's pretty easy to tell what we're going to pick. We pick that box. And now we have two options. Either we move into it, which is what happens here. We look at the two neighbors and we move the one to the left. Or else we create a number. And when we create a number, it also gets a weight. So this is the weight. Because the content is 0, n is 2, and so we get y3 minus y2. So there's that. The alternative was that we moved this guy to the left. And part of the reason that I was being so explicit about the marking is that in the usual formulation of Zipf-Pakin, you might well think that at this point, this guy is just free, right? He's bubbled all the way out to the end, and he just disappears, and we write down this guy. But no, I want to include the possibility that at this very last step, you could also create a number at that last step. So that one possibility here is just to say, okay, I do the classical thing and I just turn him into 2-1, and this is the step on which I just erase the mark. That's all I do. The other possibility is I could create a number there.
Well,
it's kind of clear that those would be bad choices. So, in principle, you could make any choice, provided it stays semi-standard. So here you would be allowed to choose 1 or 2, but a 2 isn't going to produce a T mu in the end. One of the things that's less satisfactory about this rule, I mean, depending on your taste, a thing that's less satisfactory about this rule is that it has this potential to sort of have a bit of a combinatorial explosion of producing lots of stuff which you wind up throwing away. Like, for example, you know, anything coming from these two guys, you would in the end have to throw away. So there is some scope for that. On the other hand, I really like the way that you can understand any particular instance, any particular term that you get out according to this rule, you can really see in a very clean way what it was. It really corresponds to a Zipf-Pakin procedure that was carried out and that had some weights appearing at various stages and getting multiplied together. So that's, I find that kind of clean. So here's the other one. Again, we move in. We don't have any choice about which one we move in. Okay, right. And here, there really wasn't any choice you could have made for a number that would leave it semi-standard, so you can't do the equivariant move. You just do this. But now, again, here, you have the option of the equivariant move or letting this bubble go free. Yes, Mark. Well, I'm not sure what you mean by working. Well, I'm not sure what the rate generating function is if it's not the one that I'm getting the right answer for. I mean, I didn't want to say very much about the proof, so I will say something. I'll defer a comment about that for a few minutes. Okay. So what happens here? We get this guy occurring once. So this is the T mu for the partition 2. So we get that C mu lambda 2 is 1 because this guy didn't have a weight. Oh, yoy. I'm sorry. Is this even necessary? Should I just turn it off?
No,
recording. Oh, I see. Okay. Okay. Great. Right. Thank you. This one is also a one, and then this one is the one non-classical one. We add up y4 minus y3, y3 minus y2, and y2 minus y1, and we get y4 minus y1, and so that's that little Richardson coefficient. Okay. So, so as I mentioned, there are other rules known for this. I think the first one is the Knudsen-Tau puzzle rule. I think that's the first one, and then there's the Molev-Sagan. Though Molev-Sagan is maybe, I'm not actually sure what the chronology is. There's some sort of subtle differences between what kind of positivity is sort of obvious from Molev-Sagan and Knudsen-Tau. I think maybe Molev-Sagan is first, but not as clearly positive in some respect or something. And Kreiman. So these are all rules that exist. So why would one want another rule? Well, for me personally, I feel like a good way to understand something is to approve the Littlewood-Richardson rule for it. So, that's the motivation for me. Alec Young and I have written 7 papers about Judith Takin, so apparently we can't stop writing papers about Judith Takin. So I mean, that's another reason that we're doing this. But reasons that you might be interested in. There is our project involving Judith Takin kind of uses Judith Takin to do a whole bunch of different things. And there's some benefit out of having one tool that kind of does everything rather than having different tools. So the point is that Judith Takin, there's an understanding of how to get it to deal with other minuscule or co-minuscule flag varieties, or in language that might be more familiar, if you want to talk about P and Q shores, that's something that can be done using Judith Takin. K-theory, we have an approach to understanding K-theory, which, not to say anything really about it, but it's something that looks a little bit like cohomology, in that you have a Schubert basis, and you'd like to multiply, and you'd like to re-expand, and so there are Littlewood-Richardson numbers, and you'd like nice combinatorial formulas again, and there are some, and you can get them using a form of Judith Takin, a modification of Judith Takin that we introduced. And so now there's also some approach to torus equivariance, using this approach that I've described here. So this means that since these are all sort of under one roof of Judith Takin techniques, there's more scope, hopefully, for kind of putting them together. And indeed, we recently had a success along those lines with giving a Littlewood-Richardson rule for the K-theory of auto-orthogonal Grassmannians. So that's one of these minuscule flag varieties for which no Littlewood-Richardson rule had previously been known. And we gave one using Judith Takin, using K-theory, and I should say using as a main ingredient, the main ingredient in some sense, a theory rule due to Buch and Ravi Kumar. The point being, there's Judith Takin can kind of do a bunch of different things, and so working on building up different things you can do with it kind of gives you some ideas about how to fit things together. We're hoping that the approach that I'm going to describe, or maybe not even describe, maybe allude to briefly, would allow us also to tackle equivariant K-theory for Grassmannians, and that's something for which no Littlewood-Richardson rule is known, though there are conjectures, and we have a conjecture of our own as well, based on Judith Takin. So that's sort of part of the strategy, is bringing it all into one technique and then you know, it's easier to sort of adapt to new situations. So let me make a couple more comments about this rule. You might if you're you know, up on your combinatorial Little Richardson type rules, you might be suspicious of me because you might be seeing minus signs in my rule, and you might be saying, I'm pretty sure you're not supposed to have minus signs if it's a combinatorial rule. I'm pretty sure that's a bad thing. Well, it's not actually a bad thing. We're kind of forced to have minus signs. The point is the rule should be what's called Graham positive, based on work of Graham, surprisingly, that says that these coefficients are Graham positive, and in this case what this means is they should be positive in yi plus 1 minus yi. And that's indeed our rule is positive, expressed, you know, expressed in fact in monomials in these yi plus 1 minus yi's. So that's the right kind of positivity to hope for, and we provide exactly that positivity. Okay. As regards proof, the story is not as exciting as I hope it will eventually be. At the moment, our proof involves relating the results of our rule to the results of Kreynman's rule. So that's sort of unsatisfying. Particularly, it's unsatisfying because it doesn't, we can't use that approach to prove rules where nobody has a rule. And that's somehow, you know, what one hopes to do, prove rules where there are no rules. So what we hope is to do a version, to give a rule, to give a proof that is independent, that is just based on the kind of tableau combinatorics that I that we need to give these definitions, that there should also be a proof just in that setting, and that should just work, and that's what we hope to be able to provide. A rule of that nature. The strategy that I'm hoping will work, and I guess I'll just take a minute or so to explain what I mean, and then probably end. We hope to give a proof based on insertion, and where so what that means. So in the classical. So one of the ways to prove the classical rule for a product of Schur functions, Schur polynomials, in one set of variables is insertion. So let me just try to look quickly at this example, which I had a lot of trouble doing because I decided that I should be using column insertion. And of course, I'm like probably most. No, anyway, I'm very used to doing row insertion, and I decided I needed to use column insertion, and so this created grave difficulties for me that are just a result of being dumb. So what you do, you have two tableaux. You have a tableau here, you have a tableau there, and you insert one into the other, which is which is done as a process of single insertions. So which you do in order reading up the columns and from left, so first here and then here, so from right to left, reading up the columns, inserting them into here, and the way that procedure works is very quickly, you take this guy, this 2, for example, you want to insert it here, you say, where does he fit in this column? Well, he actually fits exactly where there is already a 2, so you put him in there, and you take out the 2 that was there, and you try to put that 2 into the next column, and you see where does he fit in this column, and he fits there. And so now you're done, because you didn't have to bump anybody else out of place. You keep doing this, so the idea is that the product of 2 Schur functions, the Schur function in this case 2-1 times the Schur function 3-1, is supposed to be a generating function for pairs of tableau, this tableau and this tableau. And so how is that going to work? Well, what you'd like to do is you'd like to you do this insertion procedure and you get some big tableau, and what you'd like to do is you'd like to group together the tableau that are produced by this based on something, and what you base it on is the order in which boxes were added, so you base it on the queue tableau, or the recording tableau, of this insertion procedure, and you group them together in that way, and that gives you the pieces that come from each of the possible queue tableau are themselves just all the semi-standard fillings of some shape. And so in that way, you get an expansion of the product as a sum of short functions. Okay. So and we hope to do something like that. And in some sense, I think that's addressing Mark's question, because that there you're saying, or maybe it's not really addressing Mark's question at all. I don't know. Mark isn't looking enthusiastic about that. But. Oh, that's a good question. I should think about that. I don't know the answer, but I think I at least understand the question. So thank you for rephrasing it. No. Yeah. Okay. That's a good question. I don't know the answer, but yeah, I would like to know that the answer to that. But anyway, I think that's all I have time for. I should stop here. We don't. I guess each of the circumstances that we wound up proving something in, you know, there have been enough things that we had to tweak that we haven't sort of just turned into a big machine for solving these. I mean, each one has sort of, there's something that had to be changed. So there didn't, we don't really have an axiomatic framework. We have some sort of vague, we have some vague ideas, but the thing is, like, what things are easy, what things are possible, sort of varies. I mean, you've seen me talk about this theory this point of view that if you have a Pierre rule plus associativity, then that gives you a Littlewood-Richardson rule. But we tried using that approach to in this setting, and proving associativity is terrible. It's really not very convenient at all. So, you know, that doesn't seem like the technique in this setting. So you know, it's. There's enough variation that it's hard to sort of. There's enough variation among what are really only a small number of options that it's hard to know how to, you know, usefully make one axiomatic framework.
Say what's hard in general, please. Like, what would it be? Usually, associativity
is a sticking point, or is it usually something else? I mean, associativity is not that. Associativity is not that hard in the. In the non-equivariant settings, the thing that makes associativity go wrong is the fact that we do seem to have this requirement of the order in which you're doing the moves. If we didn't have that, then I would expect that I could write down a proof of associativity like pretty automatically. But I, lacking that, I don't know what to do. I'm not sure if I answered your question or not. Okay. I'll Yeah, well, I mean, or I'm defining it or whatever you like, but yeah, I don't know. I guess that's one way to say it. I don't know how to do shit that can't for strong tableau. So, right. Oh, yeah, sorry. What I meant is I'm assuming that if